What compromises can be reached to stop the war in Ukraine? Turkey is hosting a fourth round of talks following previous failures. Is a breakthrough possible this time? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. Their three previous meetings failed to find a breakthrough. Now negotiators from Russia and Ukraine have held face-to-face talks in Turkey to try and end 5 weeks of war. Turkey's president says now's the time for concrete results and a ceasefire. The Ukrainian delegation wants to see peace nationwide before any final agreement can be considered. Ukraine's also offering to declare its neutrality in return for security guarantees and to discuss the status of the annexed region of Crimea over the next 15 years. But Ukraine's leadership insists territorial integrity and sovereignty are not up for discussion.
The president of Ukraine gave clear instructions to our delegation. We do not trade people, land, or sovereignty. This is not a subject for negotiation. Here our position is reinforced concrete, supplied by international law and Ukraine's armed forces, international sanctions that have been applied against Russia, and weapons that have been handed over to us to deter the aggressor.
Russia's military says it will reduce activity around Kyiv and Chernihiv. Some of the Kremlin's demands include recognizing Crimea as Russian and the Donbass region as independent. Rasul Serdar has more from the talks in Istanbul.
As the new round of peace talks between Russian and Ukrainian delegations continues in Istanbul, serious disagreements remain between the negotiating parties here. Ukrainian side is insisting on international security guarantees and an immediate ceasefire to resolve the urgent humanitarian problems. However, the Russian side has tougher conditions. Russia is asking Ukraine officially to announce its neutrality, which means Ukraine not to pursue the goal of being a NATO member. Russia is also asking Ukraine to demilitarize itself. And the officials here, they said that Ukraine has shown to a certain extent willing to make compromises on these two demands. Another demand from Russia is the denazification of Ukraine. But the official says that it's very much an ambiguous term, an uncertain term, and it is not clear what Russian means by denazifying the Ukraine. However, the most delicate issue here is the territorial integrity of Ukraine, because Russia is asking Kyiv also to officially accept Crimea, which was annexed by Russia in 2014 as part of Russia, and also forcing Ukraine to recognize the two separatist republics in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk, as independent states. And the officials say that Ukrainian side so far has not shown any willingness to make compromises about its territorial integrity. The official says the road is quite rocky, but mostly the success of these negotiations, these peace talks in Istanbul, depends on how much Russia is going to make a retreat from its maximalist demands and the limits of the Ukrainian flexibility. Resul Serdar for Inside Story.
All right, let's bring in our guests. From near Kyiv, Peter Zelmayev, Executive Director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative. From Moscow, Andrei Kortunov, Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council think tank. And from London, Zachary Paikin, a researcher in the EU Foreign Policy Unit at the Center for European Policy Studies. Thanks so much for joining us today, and we really appreciate your time. Peter Zelmayev, let me start with you today. So Russian negotiators in Istanbul have said that in order to build trust, it has been decided to decrease military activities in Kyiv and Chernihiv. Is this, from your perspective, a positive sign?
I mean, as a sign, it may be positive, but once again, what's the trust, you know, in that's going to be the case? The Russian Federation has been less than, trustworthy on these issues, even before the invasions. If you remember, a few days prior to February 24th, the Russian side said it was pulling its troops away from the border. Then it turned around, regrouped, and hit Ukraine in all its parts with a massive kind of shock and awe campaign of bombing, which never really relented during this whole time. I think the situation on the ground is dictating that Vladimir Putin somehow reset his strategy simply because the Russian troops are stretched too thin, the logistics are poor, they have suffered massive casualties, 15,000, 16,000 and counting, and 50,000 disabled, soldiers, etc. But once again, what I'm concerned about, despite these positive signals that we're hearing, is that this is yet another ploy by Vladimir Putin to try to win time, to regroup and to try to hit Kiev, storm Kiev, try to invade it a second time. From what I've heard from Vladimir Putin himself, he remains obsessed with the idea of controlling all of Ukraine.
Andrei Kortunov, you've said before that a ceasefire needs to be a top priority for Russia. Do you believe that it actually is a top priority for President Putin right now?
Well, I hope that it is a priority. I cannot say for sure. Of course, the initial Russian position was that the military operation should continue till the Ukrainian armed forces are ready to surrender. Apparently, this position has shifted. I think that there are still some military objectives that the Russian leadership would like to achieve. At least they would like to get to the administrative borders of the Lugansk and Donetsk oblasts, so they could control all the territories of these regions, of course, together with the military formations of the two self-proclaimed republics. I don't know whether it can be achieved in the immediate future, but I would suspect that that remains one of the goals of the military operation. And that was reflected in the statement of Minister of Defense, Sergei Shoigu, who maintained just today that the second stage of the military operation includes establishing control, or as he put it, protecting the territory of the Lugansk of Lugansk and Donetsk republics.
Zachary Pagan, I saw you nodding along to some of what Andrei Kortunov was saying there. Did you want to jump in?
Well, indeed, just to agree that the focus of the Russian military campaign is indeed likely to be centered on the east. That's probably where the prospects are situated for the most gains, over the days and weeks ahead. The initial, significant breakout that we saw of Russian forces in the south appears to now be proceeding at a glacial pace, or possibly even being reversed in some cases. And of course, the situation around Kiev is at a standstill. So I think, forget about it from a political or strategic standpoint. From a tactical standpoint, it also makes sense for the Russians to focus most of their firepower now in the east. But even there have been limits to the extent of their advance. So I think that some of that might end up shaping the outcome of these talks. The question, of course, remains, how long will these talks continue and how long will this conflict continue? And I don't necessarily think we should be optimistic that this thing is going to come to a head in the next week or so. It could take much longer than that still.
Zachary, let me also ask you, there are these reports out there that Russia may no longer demand that Ukraine be, as they say, denazified in these ceasefire talks. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that term was deliberately vague, and that's part of the reason why it was employed at the very beginning, right? It could be used to justify full-blown regime change in Kiev, but it could also be used simply as a means of stating the importance of protecting the Donbas region, for example, and degrading, Ukraine's military capabilities when placed alongside the term demilitarization. Again, both terms, I think, could mean, many different things to many different people. My suspicion, and of course, it will be up to analysts and future historians to determine this, but my suspicion is that basically Vladimir Putin had this option of refocusing the war towards the Donbas as a reserve option from the very beginning, in the event that the war did not go according to plans and that the regime in Kiev did not fall so quickly. If that is indeed the case, that he has had this as a reserve option for some time, I think that perhaps contradicts this thesis that, Putin is some sort of a madman or that he's insane. This war may have been slightly better, planned than originally expected, as many originally concluded in the aftermath of the initial invasion.
Peter Zalmayev, the Ukrainian delegation has said that they want to see a nationwide peace before any final agreement can be considered. Do you think that is actually achievable?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, I think the Ukrainian side is more than reasonable. It is willing to negotiate its neutrality status. It is willing to consider the issue of NATO, even the issue of Crimea. You know, obviously, it's not gonna be able to sign off on Russia's sovereignty over Crimea, but it's considering currently freezing this for the next 15 years and moving into this process of ongoing debates about the final status of Crimea. I think Ukraine has done what it could short of, you know, capitulation. I think Vladimir Putin's campaign of terror that is proceeding across the board, across all of Ukraine, is actually designed to try to soften Ukraine's negotiating position. That's why I'm skeptical that, and I agree with my colleagues here who have said that this is still time to go to fully play out. And keep in mind, there's another thing. A very important date is coming up, May 9th, which is the victory date for Russia and the Soviet Union's victory over the Nazi Germany. And so Vladimir Putin has been pulling troops into Ukraine's theater of action from Armenia, from Georgia, from Tajikistan, even from the Far East. We've also heard reports that Syrian fighters and Hezbollah fighters may be coming to Ukraine. It shows you the desperation of Vladimir Putin has in order to show some sort of a victory to his people. I mean, he's lost so much blood and treasure already that anything short of some kind of a visible victory will be tantamount to his political death. That's why I think this is like a do or die moment for Vladimir Putin. He is very much concerned with his own political survival, his even physical survival, I would say. And so I think we may yet see much more escalation and much more misery before there is serious talk of a peace agreement.
Andrei Kortunov, in other interviews with you, you've said that it's hard for you to comprehend Mr. Putin's actions when it comes to Ukraine. Are you any closer to understanding them? And do you think that there are any international actors out there, any interlocutors who could offer Mr. Putin a credible off-ramp to the conflict at this stage?
Well, first of all, let me say that I agree with Peter that Putin and the Russian leadership cannot afford to lose. They need a victory, even symbolic victory, even not complete victory, but something that can be presented domestically as a victory. And this is important. In terms of a foreign engagement, I think that there are not too many people in the world who might influence the Russian leadership. Maybe Chairman Xi Jinping from China can be regarded as an honest broker, because China has good relations with Russia, but it also has good relations with Ukraine. It's a major trading partner of both countries. It's a major investor in Ukraine. So I can imagine that some kind of mediation services from China could be received positively in Moscow. I am less confident about attempts to mediate taken by people like the Turkish president, Recep Erdogan, because Erdogan, Turkey is a member to the North Atlantic Alliance. Erdogan has never tried to hide his sympathy for Ukraine. I don't think that he can be regarded in the Kremlin as a mediator, as an honest broker. There might be some other people, but there are clearly not too many of them. And I think that the task of mediation will not be easy.
Zachary Pakin, let me ask you, I mean, from your vantage point, who can be the most effective mediators going forward?
I don't think there's an obvious answer to the question. As Andrei just said, there are a number of, you know, theoretical, you know, individuals or countries out there that, you know, for one reason or another, particularly because they have good relations with both Russia and Ukraine, could serve that role. The question is, do they actually have, you know, the political will and capacity to do so? So we talked about China having good relations with both. We've talked about Turkey being both a member of NATO, but having also, you know, pursued pragmatic relations with Russia in recent years, you know, carving out regional compacts in places like Syria and the South Caucasus and in Libya. You know, people have also talked about Israel as being a possibility. But at the end of the day, each of them has their own narrow interests as well, which make it very difficult for them to be able to, you know, break out of the current geopolitical stalemate, right? China is a very good example of this. On the one hand, you know, China does have its interest in maintaining good ties with Russia for geopolitical reasons in the sort of great game that is now emerging with the United States. But China, you know, is still a rising power in some respects and needs to maintain, you know, good relations, with the United States and with the broader Western political community, economically speaking, technologically speaking, in order to continue that rise. So China is in a difficult position of needing to pursue its own narrow interests, and that's naturally going to make China a little bit more cautious. And because of the good relationship that China and Russia have developed and invested in over recent years, I think that Xi Jinping is also going to be quite cautious about, you know, potentially twisting Putin's arm, you know, and trying to get him to bring this war to an end. And that would require using not just carrots, but also sticks, right? That would involve exerting political capital. I don't think China's ready to do that. I think that that's unfortunate because I think that countries like China, India is another example, this could be an opportunity for Asia really to have its moment in the sun and to surpass sort of Europe and to inaugurate the post-Western world. But because of, you know, these various dynamics that I've just laid out, that makes things a little bit more complicated. And so I think we're headed to a little bit more of a disordered world as a result.
Peter Zalmayev, President Zelensky has said that he wants to make sure there are strong security guarantees in place before there is any kind of accord, any kind of agreement. Who would act as a guarantor? And how difficult would that be? I mean, how tough will it be to find somebody who would be acceptable to both sides? Various countries might play a part in this, but how tough would that be to make a reality? And who do you think might be the leading contenders?
Very tough. It will be very tough. To go by the track record, Vladimir Putin views any and every round of negotiation as a stepping stone to greater escalation. And once again, has shown himself less than trustworthy. We also have the precedent of the 1993 Budapest Memorandum, which Ukraine was guaranteed security in exchange for turning over its nuclear, its significant nuclear arsenal over to Russia. And look where it has gotten us. You know, Ukraine voluntarily disarmed itself, and now it's in a very vulnerable position, to say the least. So Vladimir Zelensky has said that, and very rightly so, through his interlocutor, Mr. Arakhamiev, who is his representative in the parliament, that this should be a guarantee stronger than the collective security article of NATO, Article 5. And currently what is being considered is that the countries that would be guarantors would be countries members of the current makeup of the Security Council at the UN, including obviously, the permanent five. So this is something in this sense is unprecedented. It's a completely different security architecture, but this just speaks volumes about the kind of vulnerability Ukraine finds itself in. And once again, the untrustworthiness of Russia. You know, Ukraine has to have a very, very strong guarantees. And in that respect, I think talk about demilitarization of Ukraine is a non-star. Ukraine has to have even more defensive capability than it ever has in order for this arrangement to work.
Andrei Kortunov, would it be acceptable in the long term to President Putin if President Zelensky were to remain in power? Or would the ultimate aim of President Putin be to see regime change and to have President Zelensky replaced in Ukraine?
Well, I don't know what kind of personal relations they have. I might be skeptical about any kind of personal affinity between the two men. But in my opinion, Zelensky is the only legitimate leader in Ukraine. You can probably replace him with someone else, but this someone else will not have the legitimacy, and he or she will not be accepted by the Ukrainian population. What is the alternative? I personally do not see any. I think that gradually we see more and more readiness on the Russian side to negotiate with Vladimir Zelensky. We don't know what will happen at the next presidential elections in Ukraine, but Zelensky has emerged as an international icon, if you wish. He is known all over the world. He is respected and even admired in many countries. So how can you get rid of him? Why should you do that? My take is that Russia will have to deal with Vladimir Zelensky if Russia wants to end this this conflict. So that's the only way to go.
Zachary Pakin, let me ask you a version of the same question. I mean, has, from your point of view, President Putin accepted the fact that if he wants to go forward with this, he's going to have to deal with President Zelensky? Or does he, from your point of view, does he want to replace Zelensky?
I think that it increasingly looks like it's the case that he is prepared to tolerate Zelensky remaining in power. But I think that this has a little bit less to do with just the dynamic between Putin and Zelensky themselves. I mean, it's been said on this panel already that, you know, Putin needs to be able to have, some sort of victory that he can sell at home in order to preserve his own political life. I think this has more to do with just Putin. It has to do with Russia itself, right? Russia for centuries has viewed its identity vis-a-vis Europe as being a great power and being a term setter. And if you can't set the terms vis-a-vis Ukraine, you're certainly not able to set the terms vis-a-vis NATO, the United States, or the collective West. And so this is a fundamental question, almost one could say an existential question for Russia, because it has to do with, what does it mean to be Russian? Ever since the Russian imperial polity began constructing itself, it has in many ways sought recognition from the West as a respected equal. And that has been one of the drivers of Russian national identity for a long time. So these are some very, very difficult questions that remain unresolved in the post-Cold War era, and that Russia is obviously having a very difficult time wrestling with, just like other empires, like the British Empire and the French Empire and others, also had difficulty adjusting to their novel circumstances as well. As for the notion, of these security guarantees that are currently being discussed for Ukraine, I think it's deeply unfortunate that we had to have a war in order to come to a situation where we're discussing a perfectly reasonable, albeit difficult and tricky, but nonetheless a reasonable proposal for how to revise the European security architecture, or at least revise the architecture as it relates to Ukraine and other countries that want to have a guaranteed neutral status. I think it was pretty clear to any honest observer that mindless NATO expansion had outlived its usefulness as a fundamental pillar of the post-Cold War European security order, simply because it had been rejected by Russia. And if you don't have the buy-in of the continent's most powerful country, you're not going to have a stable or durable order on the continent. So I take the notion that these proposals are being discussed right now, simply the fact that they're being discussed, as a positive indication that maybe in the future there will be the opportunity to pursue more creative diplomacy and avoid future crises.
Peter Zelmayev, you and I on this program in the past have discussed how important it is for Ukrainians that Ukraine be able to try and join NATO at some point. So if Ukraine now says that it is going to adopt a neutral status in exchange for security guarantees, if that is something that is acceptable to President Zelensky, how does he sell that to the public? Is that something they would be willing to accept?
That's a very good question. You know, there's still much appetite among the Ukrainian public for even NATO membership. But this is where, you know, politicians come in, and they have to make choices that are at odds with the will of the population. The previous speaker said something about, made a point about NATO's mindless expansion. You know, that is a serious topic meriting a whole separate discussion. You know, I would just say that for Vladimir Putin, the NATO expansion issue has been a red herring. I think what we're seeing in Ukraine is nothing to do, very little to do with NATO expansion to Ukraine, considering that, you know, NATO was not coming to Ukraine in the next few years, probably enough for Vladimir Putin to, you know, finish out his term and his life. Probably. We're talking about 10, 15 years. What we're seeing is like old 19th century style land grab, land conquest that Vladimir Putin has been perpetrating against Ukraine. And so I think Volodymyr Zelensky is going to have to make a tough choice. He said he's going to submit this to the referendum, and I think it's going to be up to him and his team to explain to the Ukrainians the kind of compromises and sacrifices they're going to have to make.
All right, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Peter Zelmayev, Andrei Kortunov, and Zachary Pakin. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.